Computer, I'm home.
Welcome home, sir. For your information, Robin is trying on costumes in the Batcave again. He's doing some pirouettes and Patrishnikov.
Hope with sounds of drinking. Welcome to season 2, episode 2 of Asteroids in Exile.
Woohoo! And it's a special episode because Niff has celebrates his birthday today.
Yahoo! Yes, it's my birthday episode. It's the birthday episode of Asteroids in Exile. So it's going to be extra special. I'm having cake. I don't know about everyone else.
So. Will you eat it too?
Yes. I think I'm going to be eating cake all day by the sounds of it. So, yeah, no, it's exciting. It's another year gone by. You can... this is going to go into that depressing, what have I done in the last 365 days?
Yeah, but I think it's also our anniversary episode because we started in February last year.
Wow. Right, there you go.
Happy birthday to us, guys.
Yeah, happy birthday to us as well. That's great. I mean, it's cool that we wanted to do 10 episodes and we did that for last year. And now, hopefully get some good scores on the board for this year as well. There's a lot going on in 2017. I mean, we thought 2016 was going to be the big year for comic book movies and, you know, everything happening in that pop culture world. But 2017 is as busy, so it's pretty crazy. So what are we going to talk about today?
We're going to start off by talking about one of comic book's most beloved and cinema's most beloved characters, the Man in Black, or Blue, depending on who drew him. and... We're going to start off with you talking about the Lego movie because I was occupied by life and couldn't watch the Bricked Avengers exploits.
Ah, the Bricked Avengers. Now, it's interesting you call it the Bricked Avengers because obviously it's the Bricked Justice League. I did watch the Lego Batman movie last week and it was great. I really liked it. I don't think it was as good as the first Lego movie. The first Lego movie had a lot of heart. But if you're a Batman fan, if you're a comic book fan, and just I think any sort of Batman fan in general, the Lego Batman movie was awesome. It was really cool. There were jokes coming like a mile a minute, just coming super fast. And it did have a really cool story as well, you know, trying to teach Batman something about life. So that was really sweet. But at the same time, it was just so quick-witted and funny. There was just so much going on. It was really cool to watch. And I think that's like, you know, as we're going to talk about for the rest of the Batman section here today, Lego is doing such a great job at putting the Justice League on the screen that it's really the best thing that Warner Brothers is doing right now when it comes to the Justice League. Everything else seems to be a mess. Lego, ironically, is the thing that's like bringing the Justice League to the screen and doing it justice. So, who would have thought?
They have the right building blocks to... I didn't think they went through.
But no, that was good.
You know, who knew?
They you could say they're master builders.
They're master builders.
Oh, dear. I know, it was great. The cast, you know, did such a good job in the Lego Batman movie. The voice acting... Like, Will Arnett as Batman's really funny. Michael Cera does the voice of Robin. And it's such a good Robin. Like, Robin's just so full of, like, joy and naivety and innocence. And, like, just... But it's got heart as well. Like, there's even the way they do kind of, like, the facial emotions on the Lego characters is so cool. I really loved it.
Yeah, the cast seems to be interesting as well because when I looked at the minifigures and everybody's there, you have a Calendar Man.
Oh yeah, the whole Rogues Gallery is like out. Even the stupid villains.
Is Kite Man in the movie?
Who is?
Kite Man, the guy with the kite on his back, the burglar.
Yes, I think fleetingly, but yes, I mean I'm pretty sure everyone makes a. Like, again, there was so much happening. Like, I had the opportunity to watch it again, but I didn't. But it's one of those movies that you can watch again, like repeated viewing, just because there's so much happening in almost every scene. And it's funny because It's so fast-paced, but there's lots of quiet moments as well. It's definitely worth checking out.
It sounds interesting because you say it has the quiet moments as well. And most people that I know that have seen it were overwhelmed by by the experience.
Yeah, I mean, like overall, it's overwhelming. But the way you get through that massive, I don't think it's quite 2 hours, but the way you get through the whole movie is they do have these quiet moments in between to give you a rest, you know. So you do get break stops through the movie to just kind of like say, all right, that massive action sequence is over, and now we're just gonna, you know, take a couple of minutes to just regroup and then go into the next thing. So that was cool. And that's what I mean. Like, they kind of set up just the character of Bruce Wayne and where he's coming from, and like the dark. They really make fun of the dark side of Batman. You know, like, Batman's always about the darkness and the shadows and the seriousness. And that's why Robin is such a great character in the way they put him in this movie, because he's just so bright and colorful. And like, he's just like a slap in the face to all of Bruce Wayne's seriousness. And it's great. Like, just the interplay between those two itself is awesome. But there's also like all the other characters around Batman that have a play in as well. So Alfred's there, Barbara Gordon, you know, and yeah, I mean, they just do a fantastic job, I thought. It didn't have the super emotional punch that the Lego movie had, the original one.
Yeah.
And maybe that was more something out of like nostalgia. And the Lego movie was kind of more of a blank slate, whereas Batman does come with its own baggage, but it was just a great execution of what Batman is. And what, and the, you know, the way they interpreted it. So go see it. If you haven't seen it, definitely go see it. It is an assault on the senses, though. Like, seriously, the music, the visuals, because it's Lego, right? So everything's bright, it's colorful, it's neon characters. It's like, we saw it in 3D as well. So it was just like, you can get lost in that movie. It's great. Yeah, but unfortunately, that's kind of the best Batman we have right now, because Batfleck is kind of a bit of a hot mess. So do you want to take us through what's been happening in that world?
Okay. I have this obsession with all articles about Ben Affleck's The Batman movie, and the last couple of years were a roller coaster, because at one time it said, I mean, it's a fact that he won't, Ben Affleck won't be directing the Batman movie.
Yeah.
But then we had news that the script is not as good as it could be, and Warner Brothers is refusing to do any big rewrites because they say it's a Batman movie. It will make money no matter how good or bad the story is. Then reports surfaced that Ben Affleck is in negotiations to leave the movie as the main actor.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't hear that, actually.
Yeah. It was stated on the Collider podcast, the Collider movie podcast. Right. Then Matt Reeves was signed on as the new director. Negotiations have been dropped because of some, allegedly because of the tone of the negotiations. And now Matt Reeves is back aboard, and the whole Ben Affleck dropping out thing hasn't been heard from again. So what's up with that movie? And what does this say about the state that the DC movies are in? Because then you have The Rock playing
Black Adam, right?
Yeah, and he's, you know, having him in a villain role as Black Adam is interesting, but as the having such a charming personality embody Black Adam, what does this say about the rest of the DC universe? Well, while Marvel is treating their villains rather bad, I might say
like Marvel's villains are not very memorable.
Yeah, they are great. They put great actors in the role, but they don't give them enough space to shine or a decent enough storyline to shine.
Yeah, I read a really interesting article talking about how, because of the serial nature of Marvel's movies, their villains can't be too good.
Yeah.
Because they're designed to be just an obstacle along the way in a much larger tapestry. And so that's why Marvel doesn't have a really awesome villain, because they're all designed to be like, you're just one obstacle on the way on a much larger road.
Yeah, but the problem
So what that means is they can't actually be forceful enough against the heroes, because the heroes have to overcome them.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, every major Marvel villain died. I've recently rewatched Age of Ultron, and even the other German actor, Strucker, gets killed
right.
by Ultron in Age of Ultron, and I thought that's one of the major foils for Captain America. And even Computer Hat Guy? Yeah. How's he called? Another classic Captain America villain, who's in the comics portrayed as a robot with the face. Anim Sola? Yeah.
Oh,
Sola dies gets blown up allegedly in.
Did he back himself up somewhere else though?
hopefully he had a Dropbox account linked to to the compound.
Hopefully it wasn't a free account. Hopefully it was a paid for, because I don't think he would fit on the free account.
Well, we don't know about compression, because you know they managed in Rogue One to get the data from a big hard disk onto a flash drive or a
true
card.
Enough. That's great.
Yeah. You know, I'm sorry.
No. I mean, we're just going down that same path, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's true. They have. So, I mean, we've kind of veered off the rails a little bit, going into Marvel territory again. But yep. It usually happens the other way. Usually, when you're talking about Marvel movies, you end up talking about how bad the DC movies are. But now we're kind of the other way. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see, like, once they finish this whole Thanos storyline, culminating in the Infinity Wars, what's going to happen next? And I think, I don't know if they've started thinking about that now. But yeah, there's still a lot of characters they can draw from in the universe. So it's just the big classic ones haven't been so memorable so far.
Yeah, and I hope we don't get into heroes versus heroes territory that seems to perpetuate the comic storylines at the moment, because you had Civil War 2 and now the Inhumans are fighting the X-Men.
X-Men.
And that's sad, because the villain roster in the Marvel Universe is amazing, as well as in the DC universe, because to get back at The Rock, putting him into the role of Black Adam is a great choice, because I think he can bring out the vulnerable side of that character, because he's not Black Adam is a very has become a rather gray figure, comparing him to the starts. It's just the anti Captain Marvel, or Shazam. He's Shazam now.
Yeah. No, it's just interesting when you say that Black Adam has become a gray figure. It's just the play on colors.
Oh yeah. And the Green Lantern as well.
Yeah. Just, you know, it's interesting. I think DC, well, who knows what's happening at the DC side. But if they can manage to really put the focus on the villains as a counterpoint to Marvel, which puts all their focus on the heroes and is building that huge hero tapestry, having interesting, potentially vulnerable, I guess you can say emotionally vulnerable and sympathetic villains will be really cool.
Yeah.
From a storytelling point of view, like, that's the best villains are the ones that, you know, are iconic, but also relatable on some level, or, you know, scary. And I was reading a book on screenplay writing called Story. I think it's by Robert McKee.
Yeah.
I don't know if I mentioned this before, but one of the things that he was talking about in terms of crafting villains is trying to make, you know, the villain generally in a story doesn't see him or herself as the villain, right? They're trying to achieve something. And I think that's kind of, from a comic book point of view, with the Marvel movies, the villains have tended to be, yes, we are trying to take over the world. And, you know, it's all very, very comic book villain. I think if DC can manage to make their villains less villainy and more kind of relatable, and potentially that's where The Rock can come in as Black Adam and actually show a villain that's, you know, who sees himself as a hero and is trying to do something good, but it's just not the right way. That can be quite a powerful movie, or quite a powerful story.
And just think of it: if they cast Michael Cena as Shazam,
then we can. Well, then we can just watch. We're just watching WWE at that point, aren't we? I mean,
yeah. But wouldn't that be amazing?
No, yeah,
that would be really sad because I think Batman is a figure that could be seen as a villain and as a hero as well, because at the end of the day he is a vigilante who's punching mentally challenged personalities, mm-hmm. and locking them up afterwards. And losing Ben Affleck in that role would be a very great loss for the cinematic DC universe.
Yeah, I agree. I think the potential of Ben Affleck as Batman has yet to be realized. Yep. You know, we got a glimpse of what it could be in Batman v Superman, and Batman v Superman was kind of like a trailer for like a larger story that is yet to come. And so, you know, what we've seen in that trailer of what Ben Affleck could be as Batman and Bruce Wayne, I think is really interesting, but we didn't really get any depth to it. It was all very surface level. Like, again, it's just Zack Snyder's style. It's just like there's no actual scenes, you know. They're all just really cool. Really cool moments all strung together with a semblance of a story. It's kind of like it's almost like visual porn, you know. It's just like excuses to get from one point to another. He's like, oh, this would be really cool, and that would be really cool. But how do we connect those two things together? I don't know. Randomly, you know.
Just do it.
Just put it in there.
In the Justice League trailer that was shown at Comic-Con last year, I thought it was funny to see, you know, Ben Affleck play a straight-faced Bruce Wayne / Batman, but putting, how should I put it? They've turned around the context. So all that straight-faced Batmanerisms come off as fun or cheesy, you know, when he's confronting Aquaman, or in the scene with Wonder Woman, he reluctantly agreed or something, where he says something like that, and that's, you know, that's something that Batman would say, but in the context of assembling the Justice League, it just sounds it sounds fun, because we know Batman will be right in the Aquaman will join the Justice League, but in this moment it's only him, because he has a plan at work, and he just feels out of place.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is he's very awkward.
Yeah,
and I think the Lego Batman movie talks about this a little bit. It's effectively he's kind of like, I only work alone, you know, and now he's trying to put the Justice League together. Technically, and I don't know. Who actually put the was it Batman that assembles the Justice League in the first place, or do they all just come together?
They come together to defeat Starro. Was that the first Justice League comic?
Oh, really? I mean, I'm going off Justice League War, which is the animated movie, and in that one too, they just come together, right? And the interplays when they meet each other for the first time.
Yeah.
Is really cool. You know, like the first time Green Lantern meets Batman.
Yeah.
He's just like, Green Lantern's like, wait, are you just a guy in a suit? You know? Effectively. You've got like, you're not bringing anything to the party. He's like, I'm Batman. So it's weird that the guy who's all about like, I work alone and I am the knight, you know,
he's
trying to be funny and bring these people together. So that doesn't quite gel. Like, it's not as convincing. It'll be cooler if it, I don't know, it'd be cooler to me if it was Wonder Woman, for example, now that, you know, in the context of this Justice League movie, that Superman's dead, that it's Wonder Woman at least there or helping, because she's much more personable than he is. And I can see what you're saying by, I think he's doing an interesting job, like, as Bruce Wayne, being the Batman, being the serious Batman from the comics, and from what we know of Batman, and saying those kind of lines that only Batman would say, But it does come off a little bit over the top when you when it's a real life person saying it,
Of
you
course,
know.
I'm the knight, you know.
Yeah. Well, even the whole thing with, like, you know, with his justification for going after Superman, which also, like, didn't make any sense. like, if there's a 1% chance that he's going to be evil, we have to take it as an absolute certainty. It's just like, that's the stupidest logic ever, you know.
Yeah, but it's the
it's not
best
a
line in that movie. If you
it's
think
a
about
1%
it.
I mean, he delivers it with conviction. I mean, Ben Affleck can really brought it at that point. You know, he delivered the line well. It's just a stupid line. Like, obviously, I think actually, I think I read that Batman v Superman actually won, like, worst screenplay at the Razzie Awards, or was nominated for worst screenplay at least.
It won 4 Razzies, I think.
Oh, really? So the Razzie's already finished? Okay, cool. So, so back to, so what do you think's going to happen now? I mean, is he going to drop out? I mean, he definitely dropped out of directing. And I think, like, practically, I think there were concerns around, can he actually direct while he's in the bat suit? Because that thing obviously is going to limit ability and vision and everything. Yeah. So,
and I think that's the wisest move he could have made, because as much as I'd like, as much as I'd like to see a Ben Affleck directed Batman movie, I think he needs full focus on the job of the director.
Yeah.
Because as you
said, I would prefer if he had full focus as a director, because he's clearly a very good director.
Yeah.
It's just the conundrum then. If he's also Batman, it's like you're going to have to choose. And visually, I think it just would be weird if they put someone else in the suit now.
Yeah.
So getting another director makes sense.
Matt Reeves directing it is a good choice, because I think that Affleck still has a vision for the movie, and he's still going to have a lot. I think he'll put a lot of weight into the creative decisions made.
Yeah.
So I think if Affleck stays on and they get a good script, it could become a good Batman movie.
Right. So remind us what Matt Reeves has done before this.
Cloverfield and the second Planet of the Apes movie, or the second reboot movie, are the first things that come to mind. And I liked the second Apes movie.
And Cloverfield, I've not seen it, but it's supposed to be really good as well.
Cloverfield,
I mean,
is a,
it, in terms of direction. Anyway.
Yeah, for what it is, it's well made, it's well put together. And I think, you know, it's there are basically then two directors on board. With Affleck, I think it's gonna be an interesting thing, like comic books, you know, writer and artist. If they both have a say or enough say in the finished product and can riff off one another, something amazing can come out of it, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be the key. I think finding a partnership that actually works well for both of them, and it's not just one person just, you know, putting all of their ideas in and the other person feeling that they're not being heard, and then it ends up being crap.
Yeah.
Or one person putting in too many ideas and the whole thing doesn't make sense.
Sense, I mean, yeah.
Zack Snyder. So anyway, cool. So that's where it's at now, right? So Matt Reeves is back on, because he was off for a while, but now he's back on. To direct. Ben Affleck is still the Batman.
He's
as far
still
as we know
the,
at this stage.
In the chair, yeah. Or in the,
still
in the
chair.
In the cowl.
And the cowl, yeah. And we can all hope, because the production dates haven't shifted, so it's still due out. Does it even have a release date, actually?
No, I don't think so. I think it's planned for 2018.
Right. Which means they have to start filming soon.
Yeah.
Because it's at least, you know, 6 to 9 months of filming and then a couple months of post-production.
So. Yeah, and who knows how far they are in pre-production.
Pre-production seems a mess. If the director is yet to even be signed on.
Yeah.
Because that's what happened. I mean, that's why, you know, we saw that play out with The Hobbit, right? So Benicio del Toro, was it Benicio? Well, del Toro, one of the del Toros. I can't remember if it's Benicio or Guillermo.
Guillermo, yeah.
Yeah, Guillermo del Toro. Dropped out and Peter Jackson had to take over, but then all of the pre-production, there wasn't time to do pre-production because shooting was about to start. And then that resulted in just the end of The Hobbit being a mess. I mean, everyone's, if you haven't seen it, the bonus on the DVDs talking about how the end, like the Battle of the Five Armies was actually filmed. Have you seen that?
Nope.
With the commentary? I think there was a clip of it on YouTube. Peter Jackson had no idea how to orchestrate and what was going to happen for the Battle of the Five Armies. And literally, people were like, they had all the extras, they had everyone on set, and Peter Jackson would just send everyone, all right, everyone take like an hour break, and he would just wander around trying to work out how is this scene going to happen. Like, they had no pre-plan. There was no no storyboard or anything. And there's like actual video footage of Peter Jackson like sitting in the middle of where they were going to film, just thinking, how are we going to do this? You know? And yeah.
Think about it. The levels of stress he must have endured at that moment and the amount of talent one has to have. If you now you have like premeditated footage that almost with which you can animate storyboards and stuff. And he shot the climactic battle on the fly.
No, seriously. That's amazing. That's what happened. It was literally on the fly. Because I think at one point he like tells the second unit directing teams and stuff, just film battle sequences. We'll cut it together later. So they didn't know what was actually going to happen. But it's just film the battle sequence and we'll put the story together later. And that's why the end of The Hobbit is kind of like unmemorable and a bit of a mess. I mean, I guess if you watch it not knowing that, you'll think, it's a bit of a shitty ending, but you know, I understand, I guess. I get it. But when you see the actual story, you think, wow, there's a lot of missed opportunity for how cool that could have been if he'd had time to think about it. So, and you know, just shows you how important planning is when you've got a multi-million-dollar movie
yeah. or any movie. But it also shows, or it reminds me how underappreciated the whole, you know, even Hollywood movies are, because even a bad Hollywood movie has at least 2 to 3 years of works of hard work in it.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of talented people working on that, because I've watched the Doctor Strange bonus matter recently and watched the movie with the director's comments, because I felt bad for taking such a big shit on the movie when it came out. I thought I'd give it a try. And, you know, it didn't make me like the movie more. But hearing all the labor and enthusiasm that was put into the movie made me feel even worse for not liking it as much as everybody else did.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a team. It's a massive team effort. I mean, think at the end of Days of Future Past, didn't they say that like 1,500 people were employed in the making of this movie? Like, it's an army. I mean, it literally does, especially for those big, big budget ones. And then, like, I'm sure 1,000 of those 1,500 were special effects artists anyway. You know, that's just such a massive part of it now. But yeah, I mean, you know, you can't – it's a shame sometimes that you end up blaming one or two people if the movie falls apart, and usually it's the director. Yeah. But everyone has to pull their weight. And I think most of the time the backstage artists clearly do. It's just when it comes down to like editing and directing sometimes from an actual storytelling point of view, those things tend to make the thing fall apart. So, yeah, well, so I guess we continue to be where we always are with the DC movies, and now with Batman specifically, hoping for the best.
Best, yeah. We're really worried.
Yeah. You know, positive. I guess Wonder Woman is due to be out soon. So hopefully nothing, you know, we aren't going to get any massive bad news just ahead of that release. So hopefully Warner Brothers is probably trying to keep tight a lid as they can on that and just release the movie. But hopefully, so that's, you know, so we're still feeling positive about that. Cool. So what else is happening in the movie world? It looks like Avatar 2 is about to start production.
Yeah, I've stumbled upon this news headline, because James Cameron is allegedly writing Avatar 5 at this point in time, 4 or 5. And, you know, do we need Avatar 2?
I mean, I thought he's been making 2 and 3 back to back in the last year or so.
So it should already be out or filmed?
I mean, yeah, I don't know how long. When did the first Avatar come out? It was like
2007 or
2007.
Yeah.
It feels like so long
ago. Yeah, yeah. You know, because there is a discussion going on if Avatar 1 has some has a cultural impact at all, and I think it pushed forward in production value and in like Jurassic Park did. What Jurassic Park did for CGI, Avatar did for more sophisticated CGI.
Well, I was gonna say, I mean, yeah, like what's that next step? I mean, clearly 3D, but 3D's kind of died now.
Yeah.
I mean, the big tell is that like none of the new TVs coming out at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, had 3D capabilities, you know? So as a gimmick, it seemed to be a bit of a failure. Avatar, the series, I mean, it's almost 10 years in between the first movie and what's about to come out. So do people even remember the first one? In terms of cultural impact, it was great at the time. It's still the number one grossing movie of all time, I believe. Yeah. But more for the technical spectacle that it was. However, all the stuff that it showed us back then is like so commonplace now. You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm interested to see whether Avatar 2 is going to be remarkable enough to take it to the next level. Like you said, you know, what's next after even more advanced special effects, you know? I don't know. But it's almost like, I mean, do you care about going back to Pandora? Is that a world you want to go back to?
No, not in this case, because I've recently rewatched the first Avatar, and the ending was a bit much for me. I think the movie doesn't warrant a continuation of the storyline, at least not on Pandora, perhaps on another planet, because I think it the story of the humans is much more interesting than that of the. And I forgot the name of the alien speed. Navi?
Navi.
Navy? Yeah.
Navi, yeah.
Because they seem all right with nature and everything. And if they didn't start an industrial revolution or something like that, there is no point in following their storyline, but rather following the struggle of the totalitarian regime that Earth is under at the moment. I think that is the more interesting storyline.
Yeah. I mean, now that I think about it, you're right. The first one kind of ended with a happily ever after. Especially since now that they've kind of like connected with the whole planet, you know,
Yeah.
like they're like one with everything. It's like almost like we've like reached spiritual nirvana,
Yeah.
you know. What happens next? It's like, well, probably not much. They're all just meditating for the rest of eternity. And so following another story on another planet, which means that you'd have to leave the Navi behind and potentially start somewhere else. It's probably going to be more interesting. So yeah, I mean, I don't really think like how can you make four or five movies out of this? Especially because
Yeah.
the first story was just so simple, you know. To me, Avatar was all about the technology and the movie making, like the technical aspects of making that movie, not so much the story or the characters, because they were all very generic and forgettable.
But then it's James Cameron, you know, under every other, he usually does things because he sees something special in there, or he sees an opportunity to introduce something new, and that's the thing that keeps me, that keeps one eye on the Avatar alarm.
Yeah, the Avatar alarm, I like it. Yeah, no, I'm with you there. I mean, James Cameron is the reason I would watch whatever it is, you know. The story itself, I mean, and so then, you know, effectively it's kind of like a Christopher Nolan movie in that you're going for the director. You're not going because you care about the subject matter. But you know.
And he should get or he thinks about doing another Terminator thing because the rights have been returned to him.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So that would be
But
that's
he's
something
so
that's
busy with Avatar.
yeah, and that's something that interests me much more. I mean, we should let the Terminator franchise die at some point because I think that 2 was a perfect bookend to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And perhaps the TV shows, the Sarah Connor whatever
Chronicles.
Chronicles, yeah, there was a great ending, I think. Spoiler, they send John Connor into the future, young John Connor into the future at the end of the series to start the whole thing. And I thought it was a that and the ending of Terminator 2 was a perfect bookend for
Yeah.
me at least as a series of movies. But then yeah, we could discuss this about, we could say this about every big franchise, like the Alien franchise, the Predator franchise.
Yeah, but mainly when James Cameron does it, it's the best one. So
yeah, yeah.
Alien Covenant, actually. What did you, so it's, I don't know if we've got that on our list of trailers.
I don't know.
Did you watch that?
I watched the trailer.
Did you watch the trailer?
But I don't have any interest in the Alien franchise anymore after Prometheus, yeah. Because that movie was, it felt below what Ridley Scott can do, because I even enjoyed A Happy Year more.
Uh-huh.
Where Russell Crowe inherits the wine estate of his uncle in Italy and right. becomes a better person for it. I enjoyed right. that movie more than Prometheus.
Russell Crowe drinking wine for 2 hours was more entertaining.
Yeah.
No, Prometheus was visually interesting, I thought, but yeah, just a mess for story wise. So and like practically, you know, I mean, I just love that scene where like the ship's rolling towards her and she's running in a straight line in the direction of the roll. I'm like, come on, you know. So anyway,
and after she got a freshly aborted alien fetus.
I mean, I think that just in terms of like that little preview that they released for Alien Covenant, it didn't really grip me. I was like, this feels like it's trying too hard. So
yeah.
Oh, move on then. Dune.
Yeah.
This is like, it's like everything you know is coming back.
Yeah.
So what's happening with Dune?
Dune got a director in, or the Dune Rebuild found its director in, and I don't know his first name, but his last name is Villeneuve. The person
Jacques Villeneuve. Is that a Formula One driver?
That's a Formula One driver, yeah.
Sorry, I'm...
That's no problem.
My wires crossed.
And he directed The Arrival as well.
Oh, right, yes.
And he's going to take over Dune. And, you know, Dune is... I've recently started to reread the book, the first book. And it's such an amazing world with so much possibility. And it's very interesting because, you know, as we are becoming a more and more computer dependent society, the future world of Dune abandoned all computers and actually employing enhanced human beings to take over computation duties.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much in there you can do.
Dune is a very dense story. Like yeah. there's a lot happening in that. It's kind of got like a Game of Thronesy, like family, like, you know, families and empires battling each other. There's the spice trade. The spice must flow. There's crazy monsters. There's like rebels, kind of like, I guess you can say the poor people or the peasant class living
and,
on
and
a
enslaved people, the
slave
freemen,
people
yeah.
fighting for their freedom.
Yeah.
It's epic.
And then you have the plans that Alejandro Jodorowsky had for the first Dune movie that came out as a documentary, which shines a whole other light on the whole franchise, because there were some crazy ideas in there that had nothing to do yeah. with the original Dune, but preserved the feeling of the book. The thing was, when I read the book for the first time, it almost felt like, it really felt like like watching it at the cinema.
Right.
It's just, or for me, it's so well written that there was an actual movie running in my head.
In your head.
Yeah. And it was.
So, easy. I mean, it's written in a like cinematic way. Almost.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's easy to follow, even though the story is so vast, the scope is so vast, the story is easy to follow, the motives are easy to follow. Dune is yeah. just a good book if you take the time to get into it.
And the design of it, the design of that world is very different to stuff that we've seen
yeah.
before, right? Like, I mean, like you were saying, so, you know, in terms of like augmented humans being the computers, there's a lot of weird stuff and almost sometimes kind of grotesque stuff in the way that world is set up.
Set up, yeah.
that feels a bit like it's creepy.
Yeah.
Which is part of what I and part of what I enjoyed about it. Part of also why it's like, this kind of makes me feel weird.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's just, you know, the Baron Harkonnen, he's a person you love to hate. He's just one of those perfect villains.
Yeah. And it's very much like, you know, the way I thought about it, it's kind of like all of the, it's kind of like what we were like in ancient Rome, only yep. now with like super advanced technology. So it's a very brutal, carnal kind of world, except, you know, it's intergalactic. Well, yeah. Or it's interplanetary at least. So that's pretty cool. Pretty cool. So definitely worth checking out. And I think, so the movie's just got a director, Denis Villeneuve, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
If I'm pronouncing the, I think it's French correctly. So we've got, so obviously filming hasn't started yet. So we've got about maybe a year and a bit to catch up on reading it before the movie comes out.
Comes out, yeah. Or
so do you think it's going to be closer? I mean, do you know if the vision so far is going to be closer to the books, or are they also going to do the, their own interpretation?
I don't know.
Because the books are so big that it's kind of hard to do the whole yeah. thing, right?
Yeah. But then I thought about that too, because there was a 3-part or 4-part TV show on like 15 years ago.
Yeah, that's the last time I saw it actually.
Yeah. And that one was already, it was good, but not perfect. And I don't know if there is if you follow the story too close, if there's a jumping on point for a franchise, or to split up the first book into more movies.
Yeah,
I'm kind of worried about that, about finding a place to make a clean cut if the whole thing doesn't work out.
I mean, because that's the trend right now, isn't it? Is that yeah. are they making a movie, or are they trying to build a cinematic universe? So Legendary Pictures, I think, is the yep. one that's making this. So do you know which studio is involved? So Legendary would have to partner with like Warner Brothers. Or,
yes, sure. I don't know which studio is in the mix. But then, you know, you just made me think you could, if you branch it out into a franchise, because Dune would lend itself to become not as big, but an equal to Star Wars with all the designs. There are some really cool toys in there if you make it right.
Yeah, but it's very, I mean, it's kind of like an adult version yeah. of Star Wars, right? Because, I mean, Baron Harkonnen as an action figure would probably give people nightmares.
But there are prototypes out there.
Seriously?
Yeah, I think, is it Jesse DiStasio, the guy from Toy Pizza who owns them? He owns some prototypes. He owns Garne, who was played by Patrick Stewart in the original movie. He showed up.
Oh, really?
That prototype, yeah. Look up Toy Pizza on YouTube.
All right.
to see what the toys could have looked like.
Because that's the thing. I think a lot of the cinematic universes are all about the extended merchandising potential. Yeah, yeah. Whereas if you're going to do Dune, like it's a dark, scary, brutal world, you know?
Yeah, but I think you could...
I guess you could...
I'm sorry. You could work this up for a wider audience, because yeah. if you think about it, Star Wars is exploring a lot of the darker alleys of the Imperial tyranny in the extra material, and Dune could do that too.
Right, maybe they could have Netflix series that goes into the darker depths of of what's going on.
Yeah,
interesting, cool. So that's Dune. So something else to look forward to. And then I've not heard of this one, so you can reveal the secret. It's a question. It's not a rumor, right? It's a question.
It's a question. Could Marvel be working on a Namor movie? Because there's buzz around the island where Aquaman is being shot on Hawaii, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That a rival production is setting up camp there as well.
Wow. Okay. So tell us who's, I say Namor, but who is Namor? Namor.
Or better known as the Submariner, he is the ruler of Atlantis in the Marvel Universe, with the twist that, is his father a human being, or what, his, or was his mother a human? He's yeah, basically,
I'm not,
sh-
Yeah, because he was thought to be a mutant at one point.
Yeah, yeah, the first mutant, and he was recently, a few years ago, killed and is now being resurrected in the Marvel Universe, in the comics at least. And he's a very interesting figure because, you know, he started out as a Fantastic Four villain and later and ally as well, because he's a rather troubled figure. I don't know how else to put it, because, you know, Imperius Rex, he puts his people first, but he also knows that he has to live in harmony with the land dwellers.
Yeah. I think he is effectively a more badass Aquaman.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. So he absolutely is. Even if he's got wings on his ankles.
Which doesn't make sense for a submariner. I mean, if he's underwater, why does he need wings on his ankles?
So unless they're little fins. Because he can fly on land.
Can he?
I think Namor could.
Last time I saw Namor, I mean, because yeah, last time I saw Namor was in like Avengers versus X-Men, but he's the king, right, of Atlantis. He puts his people first. He's got a very like adversarial relationship with the land, I would say, and in the stories that, like the recent stories that I've read with him, he has not blinked, and he's wiped out entire cities. I think he took out.
He was at war with Wakanda.
Yeah, so he took out Wakanda, right? Yeah. So I mean, it's really interesting because Black Panther, the king of Wakanda, is both a king and a warrior, and so is Namor. But Namor having the power of the ocean, effectively, because he's got that very similar power set, I believe, like telekinetic or teleoceanogenic control of like the water and stuff. But and he's not afraid to use it, and he generally will just he's not afraid to kill if he has to, and it's different. I mean, Aquaman tends to be the butt of jokes when it comes to the Justice League. Like, everyone makes fun of Aquaman. He's like, he's a laughingstock of the Justice League. Whereas, like, no one laughs at Namor. No. He's like, he's the one that everyone's afraid of. So it's really interesting the way they've positioned those characters. And I quite like Namor, just in terms of just how bad he is. Like,
he's an amazing figure. And if they really include him into something, like in the Inhumans show that's coming up.
Mm-hmm. I saw a headline that, yeah, I don't know what's going on there. What was that about?
The Inhumans TV show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that there's an Inhumans TV show.
Yeah.
But that Namor was going to be in it.
Oh, no. I thought Namor would be a nice addition to that show.
Oh, right. Okay.
he could work in it. I mean, I don't know anything about potential storylines for an Inhuman TV show.
They were going to, I mean, they're in the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., right? The Inhumans already.
Yeah.
So there's going to be another spin-off show? Is that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
No, there's going to be a dedicated Inhumans TV show. How is he called? Ash from Vicious. And he was in Game of Thrones also. But I don't know how he's called in Game of Thrones. He has been cast as Black Bolt.
All right.
Ramsay? Asshole Ramsay?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ramsay Bolton.
Bolton, yeah. He's called in. He's
the bastard of Bolton.
Yeah. He's been cast as Black Bolt.
That actor is super good and super creepy. Like,
yeah.
He was in a show called Misfits as well. It's a British TV show. If you haven't watched Misfits, season 1 and 2, brilliant. Brilliant TV.
I've seen the first season. I haven't seen the second one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's good. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Watch him in Vicious as well, if you want to see him as a rather funny character.
Oh, really?
He's really playing against type.
That's not the side of him I've seen. I can't remember his name, but that'll be quite interesting, actually. Black Bolt's a weird character because he doesn't ever talk.
Yeah.
So it's going to be acting without dialogue.
And it was neat when I told Susie, because we watched Vicious together, and I told her, hey, Ash has been called as Black Bolt. And she says, well, I wonder how he'll do without uttering a line of dialogue or only talking about it, only opening his mouth when shit's going to get down.
Yeah, because, I mean, as Ramsay Bolton, he was so creepy and so awful, you know, as in like being awful. It was great. And he had some great lines as well. Just the way he would taunt people. He'll be really, I mean, as an actor, it's a great challenge, I guess, to play a character that doesn't actually speak. Yeah. Because every time Black Bolt actually does open his mouth to say something, he effectively creates an annihilation wave that destroys everything around him, right? So
there's such a great moment in Infinity, in that Marvel event from a few years ago, when he destroys New Attilan, when Thanos comes over.
Yeah.
He's just whispering, well, not really fuck off, but like, you ain't gonna get shit from us. And he destroys the whole city with a few words.
With a whisper. Yeah, I know, it's cool. And Black Bolt, I mean, from an Inhumans point of view, Black Bolt is the king. So he's the king, like the ruler / king of the Inhumans. So it'll be interesting to see how they position that, because there's a lot they can do with it. But hopefully they don't make it like a really B-grade kind of show.
No, I don't.
It needs to be. To me, like, I imagine Inhumans being like at Game of Thrones level, you know, like with the families involved, with the politics, with the fact that there's all these warring factions or people vying for power.
Yeah.
There's a lot of potential.
And we see what's happening with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which could be a much better show.
Yeah, I stopped watching that.
Yeah, me too.
So, yeah, I'm so, it doesn't sound like we're both missing anything. No. So if we are, tell us. But I think, I'm kind of over Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
S.H.I.E.L.D. isn't even a thing in the main Marvel Cinematic Universe anymore, so who cares?
Yeah, who cares?
Oh, that came out harsh.
Well, that's pretty much why I stopped watching it. I'm like, well, if the show no longer has any interaction with the cinematic universe because of the way that Marvel and Sony, not Sony, Marvel and Disney have restructured that side of things, where Kevin Feige now, he's his own fiefdom and doesn't have to worry about interacting with the show, and the show can't interact with him. I'm like, I only have so much of attention bandwidth to pay. So I had to cut Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. out, unfortunately. But again, didn't sound like it was really going anywhere. And as interesting as the Inhumans were, it didn't look like the kind of Inhuman story I was interested in seeing. So gone. So, all right, let's change tack a little bit now, because we had a little bit of a, I don't know, is it a drum bop? Drum bop? Bomb drop?
A bomb drop.
Brain fart. I don't know what happened there.
Something amazing happened.
Something. Yeah, because I was trying to say like a bit of a dropping of the bomb when it came to the Star Wars title. So, do you want to take us through what happened there?
Yeah, of course. The German title or the international title for Star Wars Episode 8 were revealed. And because I'm the resident German expert on the show, I could make out that The Last Jedi refer to Jedi in the plural sense, because the German title is Die Letzten Jedi, and Letzten makes it plural.
Wow. Because that was the mystery of the English title It was called The Last Jedi, but we didn't know whether that was one Jedi or many Jedi because in English, Jedi would be the one that is plural, but the singular and plural of Jedi is Jedi. It's like sheep, one sheep, many sheep, one Jedi, many Jedi, right? So it's interesting now that we've got that problem solved. So it's not that there's one Jedi left, these are the last of the Jedi, effectively.
But then a colleague of mine pointed out that the return of the Jedi was referred to in German as Die Rückkehr der Jedi Ritter, which would have made it the plural in the Jedi in Return of the Jedi.
Right.
Yeah, but that was 30 years ago, so I don't know how much thought went into the translation of the title.
So in the Return of the Jedi in German, was that specifically plural? Like, is there a way to say the Return of the Jedi with a singular Jedi in German?
Yeah.
Or would it be pretty much the same?
Yeah, because the article used for the Jedi was the plural article.
Oh. Interesting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I get what you're saying. By 30 years ago, did people really study this in this much detail? as they do now.
Yeah, and there was a lot of brain wanking from my and the colleague's part that went into that comparison.
Right.
So who knew if we went over complicating things at that moment.
Technically, though, right, after the Return of the Jedi, Luke goes on to train other Jedi.
Yeah.
So you could say that, you know, his return signals the return of the Jedi as a plural, as a group. Unfortunately, Kylo Ren shows up after that and kills a whole lot of them. So it's interesting now that potentially, you know, it could still conceivably make sense in that Luke was the first of the next set of Jedi, and hence it's the return of the many Jedi. But that didn't quite go to plan.
now we have
the last of those Jedi. You know, I mean, I don't know how many of them actually became Jedi, because it's like you need to actually achieve Jedi status, right? So
yeah.
You need to go through your apprenticeship, Padawan for a while, and then you graduate to become a Jedi. So are there other graduates is the question, right? So Rey has just picked up a lightsaber and she's starting on the path. So technically, I guess you could say she's a Padawan. Unofficially.
And you know, you have to be alive to be considered a Jedi, and you know, Kylo took care of that, so who knew?
Yeah.
Who knows if anybody else escaped the carnage, and at what stage of his training he escaped, he or she escaped.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So there's potential that there's, I mean, it could also mean that Luke and Rey are the last two
Jedi. Yeah.
Because plural, you don't know. It's just two or more, right?
Yeah.
So there could be 10 or there could be just the two. So,
but 10 months.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Or less than 10 months left until it hits theaters.
Just wait and see.
Yeah. Guess we have to sit this one out.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's interesting. But, you know, if you... let's see if the German actually clears it up. Maybe that's the linchpin of their entire marketing franchise.
Yeah.
We have to translate this into German. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. How
all our mystery is going to be revealed.
Those damn right. German and their exact language.
So, all right. So do we want to flick to trailers then, you know, in terms of just staying on the movie theme, and then we'll segue into TV via trailers. So the most urgent upcoming thing is Logan. Do you have your tickets yet?
No.
No,
I'm not even sure if I'll be able to watch it with the workload that's coming up in the next few months. But I'm making time, because all the preview screening reactions reveal it to be a wonderful movie.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. You know, the trend usually is that when the movies go through those preview screenings, they do get super high ratings.
Yeah.
So like Rotten Tomatoes ends up being, you know, in the high 90s, if not 100% a lot of the time. And then when the movie goes into general release, it drops down. We don't know whether that's the case for Logan right now. But yeah, it's got like, I don't know, I think the last time I saw it was 94, 95%.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Overall, though, the reviews have been extremely positive. So very exciting. The trailers, because... the last trailer was kind of more of an action trailer. So it's kind of showed more around kind of what the fight scenes and stuff are going to look like. So that looks very, very cool. I do have my tickets. So I've booked in. We're actually going to drive out into the suburbs of Chicago to watch it in a Dolby Vision cinema.
Oh, nice.
Because we don't have a Dolby Vision cinema in the city itself. Yep. So the closest one's probably about 45 minutes away. So that's going to be an adventure. It's going to be the furthest outside of the Chicago city that I've been to go into the suburbs. So
it would be neat if the suburbs looked like the wasteland from Logan, you know, just for atmosphere.
Yeah, I don't quite know what to expect, but yeah, I'll let you know. I mean, I'm from the suburbs of Sydney, so it's not like I'm like not like, you know, I'm not a suburbs person or anything. Just that since I've been living in Chicago, my entire life has been within probably 10 minutes of the city center. Like, that's the furthest out I'd go. So it's going to be interesting.
A culture shock.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we'll see what that's like. But yeah, no, I'm super excited. I think Hugh Jackman's last outing, and they said Patrick Stewart's last outing as well. So it's going to be an end. It's going to be a bookend, I think, to the whole X-Men journey that we've been on so far. And hopefully after this, like, I'm not really interested in any more X-Men movies. They just seem to be so all you know, inconsistent in terms of quality and story and what I want to get out of them and the way I see the X-Men now, that I just want it to be over, let it rest for a while, and hopefully, you know, reboot with a new creative team after a while.
I really hope that the positive reviews aren't colored by any benefits that went to the reviewers, because both actors, Patrick Stewart and Hugh Jackman,
Hugh Jackman
deserve a proper send off.
Yeah,
and it is, and Hugh Jackman deserves a good Wolverine solo movie.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, well, Hugh Jackman, I'm the level of commitment and the level of I guess seriousness and effort that he put in over the last, I don't know, what is it, like 18 years or something? He's been making these movies.
Amazing.
It's just phenomenal. I mean, I don't think, has anyone else played a character for that long, you know?
No.
I mean, maybe in TV, but not in
the movie thing. And he defined the character for so many people.
And I think, you know, I was reading X-Men all through, like, the 90s, right?
Yeah.
But I was never a massive Wolverine fan. But seeing how Hugh Jackman played Wolverine made me a Wolverine fan.
Yeah.
Like, I was more a Cyclops fan, to be honest, like during most of my X-Men reading years.
Yeah, me too.
I was into Cyclops. I don't know. But Cyclops in the movies was just so poorly done in all its iterations. And Wolverine obviously stole that spotlight. It turned me into a Wolverine fan.
Wolverine Nightcrawler, they should have done more with the relationship, because I love how they work in the comic books together.
Wolverine, he's got, I mean, again, he's a loner, but he's got the best partnerships.
Yeah.
Like the Wolverine Spider-Man stories are awesome. The Wolverine Hulk storylines are awesome. Wolverine, like, it's obviously him and Jubilee, him and Shadowcat. You know, he's a great character to partner up with somebody else and just play on that dynamic, because his character is just, he's so Wolverine that other people bring out different aspects of him, you know? It's great. And I think, you know, they could do something like that. That's probably what's missing, I think, with a lot of the times with the Batman character as well. We've just seen Batman by himself so often being the different versions of Batman that it's getting a little bit old and boring. And one thing that the Lego Batman movie also does very well is it shows Batman's relationship with other people who are on his side, because they challenge him and they bring out aspects of his personality that we don't see otherwise. And so I think having a good Robin storyline, because, you know, to be honest, the George Clooney Batman and Robin was just trash.
Yeah, okay. You don't have to be honest about it. Yeah. It is just trash.
Trash. But having a good Robin story to counterpoint Batman, because Robin, and again, early segue, but I just finished rewatching Young Justice on Netflix, and it's like so one of the coolest shows, I think, of all time. Robin and Nightwing in that show is kind of like the more hopeful version of Batman, where Batman's all dark and depressing and serious. Robin, you know, sees that side of Bruce, but chooses not to be that, and brings a kind of like light and hopefulness to that world. And I think seeing that in a Batman movie would be really cool. Yeah. I'd love to be able to see that interplay, whether it's a younger Robin or even Nightwing, who is kind of like a more grown up. Well, he is the grown up version of Robin, who's decided I need to go on my own path because this path, the Batman path, is not for me. And just seeing that sort of, it's almost like it's a value choice that Robin makes about how he's going to live his life, which, you know, shines the light back on Batman to say, you know, these are the choices you've made to be this way. And, you know, the Lego Batman movie brings that out as well, which is great.
And we all, what is forgotten in popular media or in modern iterations of the Batman and Robin relationship is that Bruce takes Dick in Bruce takes Richard Grayson in because he doesn't want to him to end up like him, giving into his trauma as much as he did. He tries to save that boy from becoming like him. I mean, he actually he educates him in becoming more like Batman in the end, but as you said, a more hopeful version, like the Grayson Damian Wayne Batman and Robin duo, or dynamic in this case, because they are both more wholesome versions of the characters that preceded them, or the person in the costume that preceded their time.
And it's a great, I mean, it follows that archetype of a story of like a child stepping out of its parents' shadow, you know, and quite literally here, yeah, stepping out of the shadow of the bat,
Casting his own shadow.
and casting his own shadow. I mean, because we saw that. I mean, all of the Robins, when they grow up, effectively become their own people, you know. They don't just become the next Batman. Like they don't take on, and you know, they don't take on Bruce's traumas, and by the same token, he doesn't want them to take on his traumas. So yeah, I mean, he's trying to save them to a point, ironically, by putting them in danger, by, you know, allowing them to be Robin. But you know, that's just the way that, you know, that's the part where you've got to suspend disbelief to just sort of accept that this dynamic is created because you know, he adopted this kid and allows him to be a sidekick. But the overall story of the characters is then what they do with that from that point on. So I think I want to see that. Like, that's the Batman movie I want to see. I want to see more of the Bat family and Bruce being challenged by the people around him, because he's got a great cast of villains, but he's got an equally great cast of allies, you know, and they don't play on that quite enough. They've made Batman too singular and too much of a loner. And it's weird because the only, you know, one of the best ways to show that someone is a loner is to show how he interacts with other people, or how, you know, he or she interacts with other people who are trying to help or trying to be on their side.
I hope they, because it was announced that a Nightwing movie could be developed, and it would be neat. And again, please do something to keep Ben Affleck in that role, because if they cast the right person as Dick Grayson, like Matt Damon, it could be a nice, like you said, a nice addition to the cinematic Batman universe, and showing another side of the character, because obviously in the DC cinematic universe, he had a Robin, and something happened to that Robin.
Well, yeah, and so I mean, we all know. I mean, maybe we don't know, but we know the story of Robin in general,
Or of
right?
a
Of
specific
A-Rod.
Robin.
So, I mean, that's a whole episode in itself, is to go over the Robin stories. But from if they follow canon, that would be the second Robin who died, which means that the first Robin is now Nightwing. So Dick Grayson's grown up to become Nightwing and is floating around somewhere. Which brings me to the second thing, is that there was a not so much a rumor. I don't know whether it was a rumor or an announcement, but there's plans to make a Nightwing movie. I can't remember who the director was, or I can't remember who was rumored to be the director of that.
I
Do you?
just no, I just heard that it's be the it's being played that the idea is being thrown around somewhere. It would be amazing if you get the right people. It would make a great addition to the
Right,
role.
yeah. Oh, that's right. So it was, I think the Hollywood Reporter was that Warner Brothers is planning it with the Lego movie, with the Lego Batman movie director.
Oh, that's an interesting choice.
So Chris McKay, who directed the Lego Batman movie, which is, to me, I mean, again, I just said how good Lego Batman was. But that was Lego Batman. I think Nightwing needs to be its own thing. Like, going with that theme of Nightwing stepping out of Batman's shadow and becoming his own man, I think the Nightwing movie should not be. It's not Robin, you know? He's the grown-up version of Robin. So he's not the same kind of fun, naive, happy-go-lucky type of Robin that we saw in the Batman Lego movie, or the Lego Batman movie. But you know, it still has that very, he's like the hopeful, positive Batman. So I want to see that brought to the screen. I you know, I'm excited. I like Nightwing as a character.
Yeah, and there was this, you know, when Batman died after Final Crisis, and Dick Grayson takes over the Batmantle. I think it's Two-Face who realizes, since when is Batman smiling while doing battle? And that's just who Dick Grayson is. He's this, like you said, a better version of Bruce Wayne. He has the skills and the means to do the job, but he's not burdened as much by the traumatic circumstances that brought him into that role as Bruce is was.
Yeah, because you know, like Bruce and Batman is doing what he does. He's being the Batman because he feels that he has to, because he feels that if I don't, who is going to?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's kind of the logic that plays out in Batman v Superman as well. It's like, I have to stop this because not if I don't, who else is going to, kind of thing. And Batman's there, but he doesn't want to be there. He just has to be there. He feels a sense of potentially duty or, you know, still fighting his demons from the past, right? Whereas Dick Grayson chooses to be there, and he chooses and he enjoys to a point doing it, which is why he smiles, you know? And so, yeah, you're right. Like Two-Face is like, this is not the same Batman that I'm used to. You know, this dude's got a big smile on his face, and that plays out with the Robin character. Like Robin's actually excited. You know, he's like, this is fun fighting alongside Batman. And that's why Robin's always laughing all the time.
Yeah.
You know? So in, I think even in the 1960s shows as well, I can't remember now was it Chris Ward? I can't remember who it was.
Bert Ward.
Bert Ward. Yeah. Who was like Robin in generally, even when you watch like the early Young Justice and a lot of the animated shows, you don't see like when he does the thing where he's going to be like attacking the bad guys or ambushing them, before you even see him, you just hear this childish laughter.
Yeah.
You know, and then he shows up. It's really cool the way they sort of set that up. And it's because, yeah, he's a performer. You know, he comes from the circus. You know, it's fun and it's, you know, it's lots of energy and it's lively, whereas Batman's dark, he's the shadows.
Yeah, it's an act he puts on while Bruce is Bruce is showing us a part of his personality, or Bruce is showing what's left of him after his parents are killed.
Yeah.
While he doesn't put on a costume, he puts on his skin while Dick is putting on a costume.
Yeah. And it's a skin that's like, it's actually a big scar, you know.
Yeah.
The bat suit is effectively a big emotional scar that he's wearing on the outside. So, it just got dark.
Yeah.
All right. So we kind of strayed back into Batman again. So what else is going on? So we had, I think the biggest thing, I mean, let's just skip to this because it's the biggest thing, is Iron Fist is coming up, right?
Yeah.
So I know that you're super excited over that one.
I am. And for such different reasons, because Iron Fist, you know, like I put in our little reminder, fucking Iron Fist. Yeah, we get a TV show of Iron Fist. Who knew? But, you know, the trailers didn't really sell me. And last Friday or Thursday, there was a featurette released, who is Danny Rand. And you know, I mean, of course they have to introduce the characters, and I think the same, I didn't follow the marketing up, the marketing for Daredevil, Jessica Jones or Luke Cage as closely as I do for Iron Fist. So I guess they had some introductory pieces done too on the characters. But you know, if the Marvel shows are a group race where you pass a little stick. How is it called in English?
A relay.
Thank you. A relay race. Then I fear that, you know, Iron Fist is the character that drops the stick.
Already?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that just from the latest trailer?
Yeah. It could be, how the trailers are made up, but there are some small things that are bothering me, because the action looks more like a ballet. And of course, they're doing some unrealistic martial arts in there, of course, because it lends itself to the nature of the series. But never did a punch feel like it is actually connecting with an opponent. It feels like they're dancing.
I know what you mean. Like it looks a little bit like shadow boxing.
Yeah,
like,
even the small clip they did with Colleen Wong fighting those two guys in the cage match. It felt like an elaborate choreography, but not like, I mean, of course, a trained martial artist could be of her proportions under the right circumstances is equipped to take out two guys that are double her weight. You know, it felt forced. I didn't feel any sense of danger for her in that scene. And this is all promotional material, and perhaps the show will be killing it and it will be the best show of the four franchises. I'm aware of that.
But, I think, yeah, you know what? My diagnosis is that I know you're very, very excited and you've probably hyped this thing up so much in your head. And now you're like so worried whether it's going to live up to your hype or not, you know, and that's like your own hype potentially.
Yeah. You know, I sat there in the cinema when The Phantom Menace came on and I watched it a second time because I couldn't believe how much I did not like that movie.
Back in the... You forced yourself to like rage watched it for the second time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's got every possibility that it won't be as good. Right. I hope it's good, obviously. I think the trailers have been okay. I haven't been blown away. The thing that I have been blown away with, I think the actual visuals of the fist lighting up looks great.
Amazing.
I think, looks spectacular. The thing I'm worried about, though, is they've already shown it in the trailer like three times.
Yeah.
How many more times is he going to use it in the show? Because I'm sure that costs a lot of money to do that animation and they're probably going to use it sparingly. Like, and plus it's not like Power Rangers where he's going to light up every episode. Right. So I don't know. Like, have we seen each time he uses it already? You know, I hope not.
Perhaps there's, you know, because in the comics it was established that other Iron Fists projected the chi onto, like inanimate objects or used it to boost the brain functions. So perhaps we're gonna see him use the Iron Fist in other ways too.
Right.
Which would be great. You know, power up his iPod because it's old.
That'll be cool. That'll be awesome. He's doing like wireless charging on his mobile phone by just holding it in his hand. That'll be great. Actually, that would be fantastic. They need to do that. I think I'm going in with an open mind. My expectations are not so high. So I just want to see what it looks like. I'm excited just because it's Iron Fist, you know, that'd be cool. But again, I don't know how it's going to turn out. I mean, Finn Jones, I thought was a weird casting choice.
Yeah.
Cause that's like not the kind of, and it's weird. Like that's not how I imagined Danny Rand to be. Because I've read, I can't remember the writer, but the last Iron Fist comic I read was just fantastic, like visually. And the character was kind of brooding and dark. So
the Living Weapon by Cary Andrews?
That's the one. Yeah, that was really cool. That's the last one I read. And then aside from that, I know Iron Fist from the animated The Ultimate Spider-Man series, right? Where it's a completely different Danny Rand. So Danny Rand to me is a bit amorphous in terms of what he could be. I think it comes down to the interpretation of what the show is going to present him as. And Finn Jones is a very interesting choice. So, I mean, I liked Finn Jones as Loris Terrell. It's kind of like he got locked up in the cells in the Citadel in Game of Thrones, and now he ends up returning as Danny Rand in New York City. Like, that's kind of the story in my mind. So I don't know. To be seen. The action sequences look okay, but again, they're just trailers, so they're just really quick cuts. So the previous Marvel shows have had some good action sequences, like those stairwell fight scenes in like Luke Cage. And I mean, Daredevil had some fantastic choreography, I thought. And some of those fights were really brutal. Whether they can bring that here and make it its own thing will be interesting to see. So I'm going in with an open mind, which is why I'd like to hear, obviously, like I want to hear your reaction to the first couple episodes, because I think that's going to be the tell.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's with the other Marvel shows as well. Those first three episodes, I think, or this first shorter storyline that establishes each character is the linchpin in the Marvel shows. Yeah.
So, all right. So that's the plan, right? So let's watch the first couple episodes and then we'll do like a little mini episode review of what we think.
About how good it hopefully will be.
Yeah. How awesome it's going to be. Well, again, don't over. So my whole thing is I don't overhype it in my head so that I'm not disappointed when I go in.
It's hard to do.
It is really, especially when you're emotionally invested in the material. So, all right. So do we want to do a quick wrap up of what else is going on? Because time's Yeah. Going to be stretching out soon. We've already hit.
Yeah, we've hit the 2 hour mark.
Yeah, we've hit the 2 hour mark on our talk. I don't know how long we've been recording for. I think about an hour and a half, maybe. Cool. So, Stranger Things season 2. So that's in production now, right?
Yeah.
There hasn't really been a trailer. Has there been a trailer yet?
Some.
We've seen some shots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't
I remember
see anything.
There was one with the kids dressed up as the Ghostbusters.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is a very interesting reference based on like just Ghostbusters is in a weird gray zone in the cultural consciousness right now. So yeah. It's a strange reference to put in there. And what else? So we also had a first look at Infinity Wars. So they've actually started production, I think, just in the last week or two.
Yeah.
And they put out a showreel. Well, it wasn't even a showreel. It was just, I think, some quick interview with Iron Man, Star-Lord, and Spider-Man. So Tom Holland, Robert Downey, and Chris Pratt.
Chris Pratt, yeah.
And they all look super excited and happy to start the journey. So, but it's going to be a long... I think they're going to be filming for the next year or something.
Yeah, because I've read about how they do Thanos at the moment, that they have a stand-in and Josh Brolin, I think it's Josh Brolin playing him, he does his lines over Skype. Because,
seriously?
Yeah, he can't be physically there. And the whole production process seems to be that way because you can't get all the actors at once. So
wow. So everyone's just Skyping in, aren't they?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's... like we said earlier, the level of talent and commitment that goes into productions, it's being put on a test with Infinity War.
From a scheduling point of view, in itself, it's going to be a mammoth effort. So the cast is massive. I'm sure all these actors are making different movies and they're doing different things in other places, and then. With the cast that big, everyone's only going to get probably a very small amount of screen time. So you can't have them all in one place to shoot the movie because most of them, like Josh Brolin, will only be needed for like a line here or there.
Yeah.
You know, and so they'd have to like schedule all the shooting for which characters are going to be together in which scenes so that they can get those people together at a time. So it's like going to be these batches of scenes, probably all filmed out of sequence, you know, and then they have to come back and like, that's where the movie magic happens in the editing room, where they can fit it, you know, construct the movie all together after it's all done.
Yeah.
So they're filming Infinity War 1 and 2 back to back, right?
Isn't it being compressed into one movie? Isn't Infinity War one movie now?
Yeah, I mean, but those two Avenger movies will be back to back filmed.
Oh, okay.
And I think Infinity War is going to be the first one. And then I think it's untitled what the second one's going to be. It's knowing if they follow Marvel naming conventions, it'll be like Infinity War Aftermath or something.
Infinity War 2.
Yeah. So that's cool. That's, you know, that's happening. And then Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. So that trailer dropped as well in the last couple of weeks. So that's coming out soon too. So exciting times ahead. Cool. So I think that takes care of all the major trailers. Anything else happening on the movie or TV front on your radar?
After your recommendation, I catched up on Riverdale.
Yeah.
What
do you think?
It's nice, but you know, it's, I hope the theory that one person has that it's a theory from not somebody who's involved in the production or some kind of media thing, but he thinks that each season of Riverdale could be a different interpretation of the Archie franchise. Yeah, which would be an interesting idea because I think, you know, the show is every time somebody opens his mouth, I want to turn it off again because there's some horrendous dialogue and the thing with, I shouldn't spoil the show perhaps at this point, but there is a very a topic that at least I consider a serious thing that can't be just let go by firing the person.
Archie's relationship.
Yeah. I think that was played a bit fast. What I like about the show is that Luke Perry is in it because last time I've seen it.
Okay, hold on, wait. Did someone actually just say those words?
Yeah. You know, I haven't heard anything from that guy or seen anything from that guy since I was like 6 years on when the first Beverly Hills show was on. And, you know, seeing him there, like, hey, I know like, oh shit, that's Luke Perry. And
yeah.
I really dig him in that role because he plays the stoic way he plays Archie's dad.
I really like the way he's playing Archie's dad. Actually, I think Archie's dad's coming across as a very sympathetic figure.
Yeah, absolutely. He and Jughead is the saving grace, and Jughead didn't even eat a hamburger on camera yet. It's only been mentioned that he likes hamburgers. But I see the appeal of the show and how they're doing it, because it looks great. It's filmed great. For me, it tries a little bit too hard to be a cross between the Joshua Jackson show, Dawson's Creek, and Twin Peaks. It tries a bit too hard, because it comes out like a how is she called? It comes out like a Lana Del Rey music video.
Yeah, it's got that very. It does have. Which I think is the Archie influence, right? In the sense that it's got that very Americana feel about it.
Yeah.
It's trying to set itself in the modern age. I mean, you know, there's the topics that they're exploring in the show are very millennial topics. But it's still, they try to throw back to that very Americana old, you know, what the Archie comics were with going to the diner and having like milkshakes and that sort of thing. Which gives it that Lana Del Rey Americana vibe, which to me is interesting. I think it's a very cool aesthetic. Like, I like the way that looks and feels, and just that world that they've created in Riverdale. It's very
absolutely. It's just the drama. The drama doesn't sit right with me. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I will continue to watch it, because I'm really interested in where it's gonna go.
I think the mystery part of it is really fascinating. I love Jughead's narration of what's going on, and I love how I think I've seen like two or three episodes, but how when things happen, it's almost there's a sense of foreshadowing for something. Down the line, where it all comes to a head, because Jughead will say things in his like voiceover narration of the episodes. That's like, you know, and that one decision caused more problems than anyone would have expected. I mean, I'm obviously paraphrasing, and it's not with the eloquence that they do it in the show. But like, I love that sense of like, this is all a part of a bigger picture, and what's playing out now will have consequences later on. And so that's the mystery that I want to stick around and see where that goes, because it feels like someone's put a lot of thought into all these characters. Because even, I mean, the thing that impressed me, Jughead in the second episode tends to be quite a, like, his role is becoming more and more important as it goes forward. But he wasn't even in the first episode. Like, they did a lot of setup, and they took a lot of time to like set up the intricacies of Archie's relationships. And then they brought in Jughead, and when they did bring in Jughead, it puts a completely different dimension on everything you've just learned about Archie's relationships, because that dynamic changes again. You know, it's like, it's really cool the way the show is constructed. I thought it's quite clever.
Yeah, it's so, just
anyway, it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Yep.
If it doesn't go anywhere, I'll be utterly disappointed.
Oh, I think they'll have a plan. I think there's a plan behind it.
We can hope. Again, expectation versus reality.
Yeah.
Go in low, come out high.
Hi.
All right, cool. And so do you want to do a quick comics roundup then?
Yeah, because I've been, it's Jack Kirby's 100th birthday, would have come up this year if he was still alive. Yeah, great English today, great English. I was reminded of that because I've read the first and second issue of the Commandy Challenge yesterday, which is a comic book DC puts out. Command is a character created by Jack Kirby, which should have been the Planet of the Apes comic, but DC couldn't obtain the license. So they told Jack to do something similar, and he did. And Commandy is set in a far future where there's a reduced number of humans on the world, and they are basically being blasted back into the Stone Age, and an animal society have taken over.
Wow.
The world, and the Commander Challenge is a 12 issue comic book series coming out each month, and each issue is penned by a different creative team, and the catch is that every creative team ends on a massive cliffhanger that the next creative team has to solve.
Oh, wow.
And
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And the former creative team presents their version of the
resolution
of the resolution in the next issue. And So far we had Dan Abnett and Dale Eaglesham and Peter Tomasi and Neil Adams on the first two issues, and they're great. Especially the Neil Adams issue had me very excited because Kamandi stumbles upon he lands in the tiger community that's led by, I think it's called, he's Great Caesar, and he has a relic chamber. And when they get attacked by the gorillas, the relics are being brought into battle, and we see Superman's cape, Green Arrow's bow, and Wonder Woman's shield. And one of the birds who are guarding the relics uses batarangs.
Nice.
And it's so great because Kamandi goes there to find something he can use in the conflict, and I don't want to spoil it, but he finds, you know, it's presented as this big artifact with a blanket put over it, and I couldn't see that thing coming, that they use special relic. Yeah.
Okay.
It really got me riled up. It really got me riled up. And we're getting,
awesome,
because it's the Jack Kirby anniversary year, and we already got the first Fantastic Four Artists edition from IDW Comics in January. We're getting a second one this year in June. And I just got the first Fantastic Four Artists edition, and it's great. With $140, they don't come cheap. For like six issues of comics, but you get, it's presented in the original size that the original art has been drawn up on, and it looks amazing. It's such a shame that it's only available, that the original art is only available inked, because I think it's Michael Royce who inked him at Marvel.
Right.
It looks better than his inked DC work, because I also have the New Gods Artist Edition, and the inking destroyed Jack Kirby's art, even though some smaller drawing arrows, like a bigger eye or an eye that's too low on the face, has been redone in inking. It really kills the artwork, because it might be a cliche, but, and to me, Kirby was the quintessential superhero artist. Of course, we can't take out the works of Neil Adams and other contemporaries. Bill Everett comes to mind because we talked about Namor earlier.
Yeah, but I mean, he created the benchmark effectively. I mean, he's still the reference card that everyone points to.
He wrote how have I read it? He wrote the alphabet with which we talk about which superhero comics talk.
It's a great way to put it. He created the alphabet, because we're still using those themes and that iconography almost, superhero art that he created today.
Recently,
so those have endured.
And recently, I've seen the gold plaquette that's on this satellite that is going to space.
On Voyager 1.
Voyager 1, 2. Thank you. And Kirby was asked to draw the rendering of the humans.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I've recently learned about that. And he basically drew a new god version of a male and a female human being.
Seriously? That's awesome.
And it just shows, and he did it after World War II, and he must have seen some horrendous stuff there if you... because he wasn't liked by his superior in the army and was sent on some gruesome things. And to still see human beings as these pinnacles of life with so much positivity, and because they don't look intimidating, they just, he rendered human beings as these radiant figures.
So I mean, despite everything he saw in the war, he still chose to present the best side of us to the universe, which in itself is, you know,
it's amazing,
and spectacular.
And you know, if the Second World War, I mean, if the Second World War wouldn't have happened, we wouldn't have got Jack Kirby comic books, but his parents were Austrian immigrants.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so, you know.
That's a claim to fame for Austria.
Yeah, yeah. When I read that in the biography, I remember I read the biography over breakfast for a couple of weeks. And, you know, I just looked up and told Susie, oh, my God, his dad was from Austria. You know, he's only a first-generation U.S.
Do you know which town in Austria?
I don't know. I don't know.
You can look that one up. I'm yeah. Sure. Maybe, you know, there's a Jack Kirby memorial or statue or something.
It would be so great if he comes from my district, because if the stories of his behavior, you know, with being not being afraid of a brawl or something like that, he could come from my district. You know,
really,
could be a Favoritner.
The fighting district of Austria.
Yeah, well, not the only fighting district of Austria. We have a few of those, but you know, the battlefield you come from is the nicest one.
Right, it's my battlefield. Awesome. All right, cool. So, Kamadi so Kamandi is out now, right? Yep. So that's been coming out since January. And the Fantastic Four Artist Edition is in June, so that's the second one.
The second one is up in June. You can grab the first one now for the original price, because I think there are still some available at stores.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Definitely, yeah. I mean, can't go wrong.
No.
Jack Kirby,
no,
like we said.
Absolutely not. Especially with the Fantastic Four and Kamandi. That's just the best.
Yeah. One of the legends in the comic book world. Yeah. Awesome. So that pretty much covers our show notes today for everything we want to talk about. Was there anything that you wanted to throw in before we close up?
No, because we're running that long. I have a topic, but we have to perhaps save this up for a separate episode. Watching movies on a phone.
Ah, yes.
Something. Well, I had a
maybe that's a question. I mean, if
yeah, a question for the audience. Yeah, please tell us. I had a discussion with an acquaintance of a colleague because I watch a lot of Netflix on my phone, and he said I'm robbing myself of the experience, and I'm insulting to a degree the people who made this by not watching it on at least on a TV set. Because
it's an interesting question. Does the size of the screen matter? I mean, do you think they said the same thing when television was created? It's like, oh, you shouldn't be watching cinema in a TV set. You should be watching it in the theater. You know, I mean, do you think? Did that question appear before?
Certainly.
I don't. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm sure. Yeah. Interesting. So, if you do have any thoughts or ideas on does watching film or TV series on your mobile device actually take away from the experience, or slash, I guess, which is what your question is, Martin, is it actually a slap in the face, or is it disrespectful to the creative team that put it together to not get the full experience out of it?
Yeah, please write us at asteroidsinexile@gmail.com if you have an answer.
Or tweet. We Instagram.
Yeah, we have an Instagram at asteroidsinexile. And if you write us an email and you're inclined to do so, send us an audio message, because that is something that's common about in German podcasts.
Oh, yeah.
They include audio messages. So please send us an MP3 of your answer if you want to.
Your answer, question, or comment.
Or comment, yeah.
That'd be great. Yeah, I mean, because I'm just thinking now, like, you get people like Christopher Nolan, and even the Pulp Fiction guy. What's his name?
Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. Just like Tarantino, they're filming on like 70mm and stuff, because they've got a vision for how they want their product to be presented. You know, so if you ended up watching one of those movies on a mobile device, you know,
you're robbing yourself of a lot of frame.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd like to hear people's thoughts on that one. I mean, I'm still collating my thoughts, because I didn't think about this before that, but maybe we can pick it up next time. If we get some responses from people, we'll obviously play those. Cool. So that pretty much wraps it up for episode 2 for 2017. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you've stayed this far,
you're amazing people.
You're amazing people, and we love you all. And yeah, cool. So we'll be ready for episode 3 at sometime in March, and probably be doing an Iron Fist episodes 1, 2, 3 recap once we've seen those.
Yeah, it's less than a month away now.
Don't get too excited, Martin.
No, I'm trying to hold back.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
See you in a while. Bye.
We're out.
And cut. Awesome. I need to go to the bathroom as well. She heard beautify. I don't know. Okay. Take two. Peter, I'm home.
Welcome home.
Maybe it only works the first time. I know. See how useless she can be. Peter, I'm home.
Indeed you are.